This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll bring you interviews from inside and outside the Democratic National Convention Hall. Eli Smith traveled from New York City to Philadelphia to talk with people in the streets and in the convention hall. We'll talk about a recent report by a police accountability task force in Chicago. The report makes the bold claim that police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last week, Eli Smith attended the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. We go now to hear several on-the-street interviews with individuals attending demonstrations, activities in and outside the convention hall, and evening discussions centered on our collective next steps. Let's take a listen.
This is Eli Smith reporting from the first day of protests at the Democratic National Convention on Sunday, July 24th, starting out with a climate change protest that's just getting moving here out front of Philadelphia's City Hall.
My name is Elise Gerhart, and I'm a rural central Pennsylvanian, and my family is experiencing the pipeline infrastructure build-out that's happening across our state right now. Our state wants to put in 30,000 miles of pipelines over the next 10 years to expand the fracking industry. And so my family was approached last year by Sunoco Logistics, who wanted a 3-acre easement to our property there, property where we live, and my family said no. So the company immediately sued us for the property through the process of eminent domain. And unfortunately, the judge that presides over our county, he ruled in favor of the company earlier this year. We've also faced forceful repression for trying to fight it. When we lost eminent domain and we appealed it and they came into the property anyway, we physically tried to stop them by setting up a series of tree sits. And five people wound up getting criminal charges put on them. My mother, who's a retired special education teacher, she spent 32 years in the public school system here in Pennsylvania. She was taken to jail for 3 days, put in solitary confinement, denied the right to talk to a lawyer, denied the ability to call her husband, who is elderly and she is a caregiver for. And so the whole thing's just been a mess. We're just really being abused by the industry with the help of the courts, with the help of our own government. So that's what we've got going on. And I came to Philadelphia today because, one, I was invited to come to speak about our situation. When I tell people this story, you know, they get really kind of, they're like surprised, they get confused. They're like, how could that happen? You know, how can that happen in America? And what's going on is we have these politicians that are just being, they're not just turning a blind eye. They're actually facilitating this process. We really don't have anyone in power that's on our side. So we've been trying to do what we can to take that power ourselves because we feel like we have an obligation to, as Pennsylvanians, to stand up for our Constitution, you know, especially the environmental clause that says that we have a right to clean air and pure water and the preservation of our environment. We are standing up for the United States Constitution, which says that we have a right to be secure in our property. And like I said, we're just right now being told that we don't have those rights.
My name is Alesha Vega. I'm the Associate Director of the Coalition for Peace Action. We're one of the oldest peace advocacy groups in the region. We're headquartered in Princeton, New Jersey, but we do cover, we are a regional organization. We cover Central Jersey, South Jersey, Philadelphia, and parts of Pennsylvania. I think a lot of our leaders, not only within the United States, but around the world, don't realize that there's a clear connection between the climate crisis and war, as well as climate refugees, as we notably have seen the drought in Syria that began in 2005 that caused the displacement of millions of Syrian refugees from urban to rural areas, ultimately causing conflict, civil conflict, and war, and climate refugees, essentially. So that we're making that connection with the climate issue and even Brandon fracking. All of these things are related. They have to do with climate injustice. So we want to ban fracking now. There is no short term. We don't have the time. You know, people want to talk about making small steps. We can't afford to make these small steps anymore. We talked enough about it. We need action. We need to make giant leaps. We need to transition to 100% renewable energy. And we know how to do it. It's been done. The state of California, it's on its way. There's already been 80,000 renewable energy jobs created in New York State alone. The city of Vermont, or city of Burlington, Vermont, is run on 100% renewables. We know how to do it. The resources are there. The science is there. But our leaders, not only the Democrats, but the Republican leaders, they're in the pockets, they're in the hands of the oil and fossil fuel industry, and we need to make these demands now. And a big step that people can do is go out to our website, the peacecoalition.org, and find out how to speak to our representatives, speak to our senators, peace lobby, and tell them what our demands are.
It's Sunday and the first day of protests at the Democratic National Convention. We've just heard sounds of the climate change, ban fracking protest march, which will be immediately followed by a pro-Bernie Sanders march. These marches are gathering at and departing from Philadelphia's City Hall.
Dump the elephant, dump the ass, build the party of the working class.
Clinton establishment, the neoliberal regime that we've been living under for so long, whether it's Reagan or Clinton or any one of these, they're all of essentially the same creed. They've bred the mass unrest that has led to Trump. So why would we want to back the ideology and the candidate that is the representative of why people endorse Trump in the first place?
We're calling for a party of the 99%. We're calling for people to stop voting for, to just say no to lesser evilism, to stop voting for the platform that exists and to start actually building a platform that represents the values of us. You know what I mean? We're tired of settling for less than what we deserve.
In concrete terms, we're working and backing Jill Stein. Like, we're working with the Green Party and they're our allies right now in trying to build this more mass movement. And it ranges, our sort of umbrella organization that's forming is between all Greens, progressives, and socialists sort of coming together under, that's what we're trying to do, is get them together under one banner. Donations have increased 1,000% since Sanders endorsed Clinton. And that's a precedent we have to look towards. And like 50%, I saw a statistic, about 50% of the Bernie supporters previously have gone over to Jill Stein, which is not insignificant.
Right.
And we can build off of that.
Equality Coalition for Camden. we have the, you know, buses out here, and we have vans, and we have people here.
It's a great bus you have, Black Men for Bernie, a big bus that just pulled up.
Yes, because the reason why we're here, because we actually want to show that Black men are actually concerned with the political process. We're concerned with our communities. We care about our communities. We care about our families. I have hundreds of friends that are locked up right now who can't come, and also their ancestors who lived through me, and I'm here to represent all of those life forces. I'm here to represent all those spirits. All that spirit is inside of, all that energy is in me right now.
In your mind, what's the way forward? What's the next step that you can think of?
The next step is to steadfast and consciously pay attention to what's going on, to all be a part of the political process and pay attention to what they're doing in the communities, and make sure that we have a voice in all of the process, anything that goes on in the communities, we have a voice. Picking a lesser of two evils, that's very lazy.
Yeah.
That's very lazy. We're not a lazy country. Look at all the stuff we built. We have people all over the world watching us. We cannot be picking less of two evils. We just had an awesome president. Some people may not like him. It may, you know, want to dig up some dirt on him. But overall, he was a very intelligent, respectable man, Black man. How can we go from here to here?
Well, I actually started working on Bernie's campaign about a couple months before he announced he was going to run officially. What first drew me to him was his stances on the environment.
Yes.
But then it's turned into more things since then. The biggest threats facing the world, the United States specifically, is money and politics. And the world corporations are just running the entire world, getting whatever they want. So we have to get money out of politics. So, I would love it if every one of those superdelegates that were awarded to Hillary Clinton by her good buddy, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, be nice if they actually woke up and voted their conscience, rather than vote for someone who's just going to take care of them later so they can maintain their power base. That's it. That's all that's about. They don't care about the people that live in this country. So, I hope to bring attention to Bernie Sanders, and if he doesn't get the nomination, which he won't, Hillary Clinton's shown a remarkable ability to rig elections, the movement continues.
I'm Jonah. I'm coming from New York City, and I came down because I love Bernie Sanders, but also I'm interested in the importance of the larger movement and what it represents and what is a continuation of Occupy, Black Lives Matter, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. This is beyond one person and one presidential campaign. And it's exciting to be here with so many people dedicated to making the world a better place.
I'm not voting for Hillary. I'd like to see a third party that's for the people sprouting from this. So hopefully the Bernie supporters will start building.
I believe the Green Party is a very good alternative. I feel that we have a responsibility not only to this country, but to the world, because everything that we do here affects the world, and we don't have good candidates at this point in time, except for Bernie or Jill. I cannot in all good conscience vote the two that are in.
With election politics rigged so much, you know, the Election Justice USA has documented that, as long as so many other organizations, that the whole question of the lesser of two evils is a distraction from the larger systemic problems that we face. So we really need to look at things at their core existential level, and look at the dangers faced by the planet, and look at every decision we make, every word that we say, every moment we have to dance on this earth as an opportunity to move towards a true revolutionary change of and for the people. That's a true peaceful revolution. That's not going to be about the lesser of two evils or any of those other distractions.
Well, thank you all so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to try to head inside of the Democratic National Convention now, at least for a little while.
My name is Ariel DiLiberto, and I'm here with Philly Socialists.
We're here at the Socialist Convergence, which is like an alternate sort of convention or gathering at the same time as the Democratic National Convention, and I was wondering how it was that you came to call this convergence and what you're hoping to accomplish here.
So as soon as it was announced that the DNC would be in Philadelphia, we recognized as a prominent socialist organization here in Philadelphia that this was a huge opportunity. We knew that Bernie Sanders was not going to get the nomination, even all those months. It may have even been almost a year or a year before. And we knew that people were going to be angry and that there would be lots of protests and that people would be looking for an alternative. So we saw this as an opportunity to organize to show there is an alternative. And it's not within the Democratic Party, as we see that failed. And as we've seen most recently, it failed with intention from within the Democratic Party, in part. But we also always knew that change was not going to come from within the Democratic Party. So this was really an opportunity for kind of this massive change in consciousness of people realizing that, people who had really bought into the Bernie campaign for all the right reasons, because of the hope it promised. And this was an opportunity to get, you know, Philly socialist name out there, but more importantly, get the idea of the need for a third party out there. And so we wanted to show up, be really organized, have something for people to go to, something for them to do, something for them to learn, and that's kind of what this week is about.
Did Philly Socialist endorse the Sanders campaign, or are you simply trying to reach his supporters?
So I mean, at this point, we're a non-sectarian group. We don't have a party line. We did not endorse the campaign. We had plenty of people within the organization who were very excited about it, volunteered for it, voted in the primaries. But as an organization, it was important to us because we knew what was going to happen all through the nomination, that rather than throw all our resources behind this fleeting moment that we knew would be defeated, we knew that the work to build a third party is actually much deeper and longer term, and we wanted to continue investing in the work that we've been doing for that and then be able to, you know, present people who are supporting Bernie with that work.
Do you see a third party as a kind of left coalition party that has yet to emerge, or do you feel like it's already here with the Green Party, or what's your thoughts on that?
I think it is going to be a left third party that has yet to emerge, and that's kind of maybe the unstated goal, or at least some people's goal with this convergence, is to plant the seeds of that. We have so many amazing people from so many different leftist organizations here. And, you know, I was just in the overflow room because the actual panel discussion is at capacity. And in the overflow room, it's just other members of these organizations kind of talking about what do we want, what are the opportunities. And everyone agrees. It's just time to kind of bring everyone in the same room to see that.
What are you calling for, or what's the next step? What are you going to do in the weeks and months after this convergence? That's a tough question, I'm sorry.
No, it's not actually tough. I'm just not sure. I know that Philly Socialist has an idea of what we'd like. I don't know how shared it is with the other organizations at this point, but some sort of coalescing around the idea of one unified party, and then possibly starting a couple seed organizations on the ground in some cities where a lot of the groups that are here aren't active already, to kind of try to actually start building that party on the ground, possibly borrowing from a lot of the models that our organizations already use, but just kind of as a kind of experiment testing ground to see if we can move this National Front idea forward in, you know, a new city. And also, I guess that is also a way to kind of not step on anyone's turf if we start out in a new city that, you know, doesn't already have prominent Democratic Social of America chapter, isn't Philadelphia with Philly Socialists, and, you know, in the beginning people can kind of get used to this idea of a unified group without having to all of a sudden throw out their identity at the get-go.
Are you affiliated with groups in any other cities, or it's really just local to Philadelphia?
So we have at least one kind of formal sister group, Kentucky Workers League in Lexington, and they had kind of already gotten some sort of socialist group started, and they had heard about Philly Socialists and connected with us, and we actually ended up sending some representatives down there and doing some organizer training. They're now extremely high functioning, and you know, we share best practices, we share similar models, and we have a shared leadership retreat every year now. We meet kind of halfway in West Virginia, and we each train each other on, you know, areas of, that we have expertise in. And the thing about building a third party is it takes time, and it takes a lot of work on the ground, and it takes not compromising anymore. And to me, that's just compromising again. So while people within our organization may vote for Hillary, there definitely won't be any endorsement on our part. You know, we're not going to just keep working in a culture of fear. We're trying to actually work towards a vision of something better, and that tactic has definitely scared generations of voters. And also, I would say the biggest problem in this country is voter turnout. So it doesn't actually matter if someone votes for Jill Stein so much as that people aren't voting at all, and particularly people who may be considered the Democrats' base or what used to be their base, lower income folks who saw them as an ally, aren't even turning out to the polls anymore, as well as younger folks, disenfranchised millennials. So that's really the problem, you know, not that someone votes for Jill Stein.
Are there any campaigns that Philly Socialist is working on right now, and anything that's on the horizon that you're building towards?
Yeah, so our model has always been to organize through on-the-ground projects that both either directly serve the people of Philadelphia or challenge the power structures, and also simultaneously actually organize people by, you know, getting people who just maybe want to do good involved, and they end up getting involved in the organization, and working with working class people on their struggles. So the way we do that, one of our main projects right now is the Philadelphia Tenants Union, which we helped form. We kind of seeded it starting a couple years back. It's now its own organization, but we're still kind of connected, and it's still, we consider it for the time being a project of ours, kind of under our umbrella. And the Tenants Union kind of has two different branches to it. One is directly fighting the power through direct action campaigns against slumlords. We had been doing this as Philly Socialists before the Tenants Union formed. So that means just devising a campaign of escalation against a slumlord when a tenant comes forward to us with a list of grievances. So you just start out by writing a demand letter to the landlord saying, you know, here are the issues we'd like resolved. Here's how we want them resolved. You can do it by this date, or, you know, you'll be hearing from us again. They never respond to that, so it usually goes from there. So you can start by flyering all their other properties to let them know, like, did you know your landlord is doing this to one of their tenants, showing photos of the condition of the property. You can do things like make an appointment to view one of their properties, and then stage a protest that happens when you show up to view their property. So you then act as the shocked potential tenant, and the landlord starts to realize this is really becoming a problem. We've had to go as far as show up at a landlord's church to say, you know, this churchgoer of yours is actually doing this to their tenants, and eventually it works, and we've gotten thousands of dollars in reparations given back to tenants, thousands of dollars in unpaid rent forgiven that they were withholding because of the conditions that the landlord was trying to evict them on. Instead, we got that forgiven, so it definitely works. The other branch of the Tenants Union is legislative work, so trying to expand tenants' rights in the city charter. So right now we're working on something called a just cause eviction, which means that landlords can only evict for certain reasons. And it's one of those laws that you would think already exists, and other cities it does exist. It's not very sexy because of that, but we see it as a stepping stone to rent control, and just cause and rent control actually work very well together. So that's kind of the ultimate goal. But right now we're working on the just cause eviction, and we're collecting signatures, lobbying council people, because we have one council person interested in endorsing it, but we don't have a second. So yeah, that's some of the on the ground stuff we're doing.
Well, would you tell me your name and the group that you're here with?
I'm Justin Harrison, and I'm a local organizer with Socialist Alternative here in Philadelphia. There is huge vacuum on the left, indicated by Bernie Sanders' campaign, where he's managed to mobilize millions of people around very clear demands for $15 minimum wage, around a Medicare for all. He's challenged Democratic Party establishment, so that we think that we should use this opportunity to reach out to newly radicalized people and try to connect with them and move the ball forward on building independent working class politics. So that's sort of where we're coming from. So why are we here in this space tonight? Is we saw it as a way to work locally with allies on the left, but also there's a lot of people in town coming here for the DNC that are looking for answers or way forward. And I think that's a big question right now for people, is what's the way forward after the endorsement of Hillary by Sanders and after the DNC closes on Thursday?
Did Socialist Alternative, support Sanders' candidacy during his campaign? He's a capitalist candidate, but how did that play out?
Right. We critically supported his campaign. Shama Sawan, who's a city councilor in Seattle, who is a member of Socialist Alternative, independent candidate, kicked off Moving for Bernie as an independent national campaign to support the candidacy. We did not work inside officially the Bernie Sanders campaign or inside the Democratic Party, but we did organizing outside the party. Organized, like here in Philadelphia, for example, we helped organize several marches around the clear demands for $15 minimum wage, for racial justice, against police violence, on housing issues, and trying to politicize the movement and broaden it out. So it looked different in different cities, but sort of that was our national attitude towards it. So,
are you now supporting, organizationally, a Socialist Alternative supporting Jill Stein and the Green Party, or calling for a left coalition party to form in the future?
We feel that the best way forward in the immediate situation is a vote for Jill Stein to show opposition to the two-party system, to cut across lesser evilism. And so that's where we are right now. We also feel that there's a crying need to look towards building independent working class campaigns, and we would encourage everybody on the left to seek every opportunity to do that within coalition with us or others, whoever. I mean, we have to have these local conversations, what that looks like locally, and there's lots of places where that's not practical, people won't agree, and it will look different. There's national problems, and then these things are solved on the local level.
Well, the two-party system and the Electoral College and things like that, it's so bad compared to a parliamentary system. How would it be possible to overcome that, and what do you see as the future in terms of a third party, a left party? How might that take shape in your mind? I know it's a big question.
It's a very big question, and there's a lot of greater and lesser minds working on that, trying to figure it out. And to a degree, like we're talking about trying to predict the future. I mean, if we base it on an analysis of where we're at in the U.S., that it seems like the forces that could move that forward right now are the unions. The AFL-CIO could break with the Democratic Party. They're probably not going to do that in the short term. Bernie Sanders, we were agitated, could have run an independent campaign. Maybe he wouldn't have won. Maybe it wouldn't have been as effective, but it would have really raised the bar on what that looks like going forward. We put forward a public position that after he lost a primary very clearly to Hillary, that he should have called a convention in August or September to bring together the forces around him instead of putting those forces back in the Democratic Party. He clearly disagrees with that, and is that he has a perspective of taking over the Democratic Party from the ground up. We don't think that will work. We think that that party is tied through tradition and money and very clear lines to Wall Street and big business in this country, and that's who they represent. So that means it's left to people on the ground. So on the left, a lot of times it seems like we're isolated into either just conducting these campaigns and protests and without thinking about how to take power, or it's directed into sort of like pure sort of electoral work, something like that. We think that there's a positive feedback loop. And if you look at what we did in Seattle, where we had to build the campaigns around these issues to run the candidacy, and the candidacy fueled the campaign. And then once you take the seat, then you use that seat not just to stick that person up there and write pretty legislation, but use that seat as a public pulpit to help build the campaigns to support the legislation you're trying to put through. And that's how we won 15. It wasn't just by clever negotiation. It was by mobilizing people on the ground to support what we're doing inside city council as well, independently of the Democratic Party, without taking any corporate money. And I think that we clearly shown it's possible to do on a local level. I think that the Sanders campaign has clearly shown it's possible to do on a national level. The fact that other people aren't doing it is representative of the political vacuum we were in. So where does that leave us? I mean, I think that means that we have to keep trying, that we have to reach out to these people here in Philadelphia this week. We have to build our forces, educate ourselves, and we have to look for local opportunities wherever they arise to move the ball forward. The short answer is, in the current situation, we have a big picture of what this thing looks like, but the solutions are hyper-local. And it's not in trying to take over the Democratic Party. It's not in just movement building and this sort of protest, but it's how do we build power on the local level, and not abstractly, but build power to take power. So dog catcher races, city council races, school board races, wherever we have the opportunity to move the thing forward.
Kashama Swant's victory, electoral victory in Seattle, was such a powerful statement and such a big victory. I think the reverberations of your all's great work there and her great work there are still very much being felt all over. I wonder if I could ask you if Socialist Alternative has a position on that. I mean, Hillary has certain things that she will do. She accepts climate change as a reality. She would ostensibly support women's rights as opposed to Trump.
Well, I think it would seem abstract and sectarian to say that there's no difference between Trump and Hillary Clinton. Obviously, for a lot of people in this country, there's a difference in terms of the way they see the racist violence and the racist mood whipped up around Donald Trump's campaign, what it would look like to have a women president, which feel like a breakthrough for people, for progressives in the country. So there's lots of reasons why we get into details of why I think that they are not exactly the same. So I think people on the left, some people on the left will say, like, well, they're just all the same. Doesn't really matter who you vote for, or what you do. We understand the problem of lesser evilism. I understand why somebody would vote for Hillary in the situation, not Jill Stein, which is what we're calling for, right? Or vote against Donald Trump, as the case may be. The key question, I think, is we have to ask ourselves, how did the political space develop for somebody like Donald Trump to have the role he did? And who is accountable for that? And the Democratic Party is accountable for that. The Democratic Party establishment around Hillary Clinton, with the austerity policy they pushed through, is directly accountable for creating the political space for someone like Donald Trump to pose as a savior of white working class people against these liberals that want to tax them to death and close their schools and all the racist stuff that flows from that. We don't agree with his analysis, but it's out there and it finds an echo. So then the question is, okay, I understand you're going to vote for Hillary because you're afraid of Trump and there's all these evils associated with Trump. What happens November 3rd? Right, that movement that's been whipped up is not just going to go away. And what's the best way to defend ourselves against the racism and white supremacist organizations that are forming around him, as well as the reaction around that? Are the Democrats going to do that? And I think they've clearly showed that they're not going to. Hillary is down there already moving to the right. She's looking at Trump and she's saying, like, okay, I've got my lesser evilism card as Donald Trump. I've got the unions in my pocket. I've got the progressives in my pocket. I've got Sanders delegates in my pocket. So now I'm going to swing to the right and solidify my Wall Street vote. And the rest of us are left holding the bag. And she's going to say, well, what do you want? Did you want Trump or you got me? It's like, okay. And that's where we're going to find ourselves on November 3rd. And she is not going to defend us against Donald Trump. We have to do that. I mean, I think that sometimes the question is artificially posed like it's just a matter of building movements. No, I mean, yes, we need to build our fight back, but we have to organize in our unions, in our schools, in our workplaces where we don't have unions, in our neighborhoods, but with the focus on how do we move this thing forward to build this independent working class party. And that's how we defend ourselves against Trump. That's how we defend ourselves against the right.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
My name is Todd Cretian. I'm with the International Socialist Organization.
And what brings you and your organization to Philadelphia to the Democratic National Convention protests this year?
Well, we are here at the Democratic National Convention, as you said, for the protests and not for the convention. What we see going on inside the Democratic Convention is unfortunately absolutely status quo for the Democratic Party, which is fake left and then move right to the center.
We're in the center courtyard of the Philadelphia City Hall, which is this ornate 19th century interior courtyard where people were just marching through, joining another anti-Hillary, pro-Bernie Sanders march.
The way I look at it is the Trump presidency is extremely frightening. And as Donald Rumsfeld used to say, it's the unknowns which are frightening.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true. Donald Trump is going to try to build a wall on the border. The reality is that Bill Clinton, George Bush, and Barack Obama already built a wall on the border. And Barack Obama has deported millions of people, as did George Bush, as did Bill Clinton. The danger of Donald Trump and foreign policy is real. And I don't want to downplay that at all. But the disasters of the wars, which have been unceasing since the Bush the father, have been unceasing. And Hillary Clinton is one of the key architects of those wars. So Trump may do more, but we have to understand that what we're standing on is bad enough. The mass incarceration system was built by Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And so what we're struggling against is this legacy. I think a Donald Trump presidency would embolden the police. I think he would take reckless actions internationally. I think it would embolden the racist right wing. That is absolutely true. However, I think the cure for that is not a Hillary presidency, which will only double down on the policies which are creating the resentment and creating the anger. Either way, Hillary or Donald, what scares me more than either of them is us not having a mobilized social movement, us not having unions who are willing to go on strike to fight for their rights, us not having an environmental movement who says the planet is burning and Hillary fracking Clinton will not stop it. If we do not have, I'm not talking about hundreds and thousands of people in the streets, but if we don't begin to have tens and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, if we don't have hundreds of thousands of people going on strike to defend public education, if we don't have a mass third-party alternative to challenge the two-party system, then what we're really picking is how fast do we want to be in the car hurtling towards the precipice. We have a finite number of time to mobilize ourselves and organize ourselves. My rough back-of-the-envelope math is that we have 20 years in this country to put together a revolutionary mass movement to challenge these two parties. If we wait another four, and then another four, and then another four, we've lost 60% of the time we have left to save this planet. The time is now. Jill Stein is an important part of that. The Green Party's not the whole answer. We need a coming together of everybody who recognizes that capitalism and its two-party system have to be challenged from top to bottom.
And how can people get involved with the ISO, or what would you recommend that people that may be listening to this program can do right now?
I would really encourage people to, I love Facebook, it's great, it spreads the news, but people have to join organizations. People have to train themselves to be lifelong activists. They need to build grassroots organization where they live, in their union, in their neighborhood, in their school. And if we don't develop a generation of people that gets off the internet and gets into the streets, then we can protest. We can make our views known, but they don't care about our views, and they don't care about so much about symbolic protests. What they care about is power. And if we can't make our unions more active, if we can't make our neighborhoods more active to stop gentrification, if we don't build mass movements, what we need right now, we need millions of people, but before we get millions of people, we need thousands of organizers who dedicate their lives to learning the history, to getting out in the streets, to building local organization. As a socialist, as a member of the ISO, I would encourage people to join the ISO. If you're not going to join the ISO, join another organization, but become part of an organization or a trade union or a student group or a community organization and figure out how you're going to help be part of the solution. That's a difficult thing. I think it's a long-term thing. But if we want millions of people to be on our side, then 10,000 people in this country need to decide that starting this year, With the millions of people who want socialism and have been following Bernie Sanders, we need 10,000 of those people to say, I'm going to be one of the people who holds things together, who organizes my neighbors, my coworkers, my classmates. And that layer of people can't simply be observers. They have to be participants. So, you know, as a socialist, we put a lot of effort, a lot of emphasis on what Karl Marx used to say, which is that socialism has to be the self-emancipation of the working class, that ordinary people have the power. We don't need saviors from on high. We need tens of thousands of people who are going to be the organizers. What we're going to be doing in about an hour and a half is going to be marching with the Equality Coalition and a march for civil rights against gentrification down to the convention center. We're going to be meeting up there with the Power to the People rally that Jill Stein is putting on with a great program of speakers. And then later tonight, we're all going, and then for the rest of the week, every night, we're going to the Socialist Convergence, which is at the American Friends Service Committee House. And people are absolutely welcome to check that out online. And we really encourage people, if you were somebody who had your heart set on Bernie and now you're getting Hillary, come check out the Socialist Convergence. You can find it on Facebook with all the directions. And you're going to hear Kianga Yamada Taylor about her book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. You're going to hear Jill Stein. You're going to hear Bhaskar Sankara from Jacobin. You're going to hear Amy Muldoon from the International Socialist Organization. You're going to hear Kashama Sawan from Socialist Alternative. You're going to hear Chris Hedges, award-winning author, et cetera. You're going to hear a bunch of people making an argument about how we can start to put this alternative into the streets and into the voting booths. WBAI and the Pacifica Radio Network are real champions, and I don't know where we'd be without them.
Thank you.
That was a compilation of interviews collected and edited by Eli Smith, who attended the Democratic National Convention last week in Philadelphia. A recent report by a police accountability task force in Chicago makes the stunning claim that, quote, police have no regard for the sanctity of life when it comes to people of color. 3/4 of persons shot by Chicago police in a 7-year period, 2008 to 2015, were African American, although they comprised just 1/3 of the city's population. The nearly 200-page report, however, does not lay blame entirely on the Chicago Police Department. It cites generations of poverty as contributing factors, including, quote, an alarming lack of jobs in certain neighborhoods and a lack of basic community services and support networks, such as good schools, daycare, churches, community centers, parks, and even grocery stores. Joining us to talk about this report is Professor Nirej Sikhon from Georgia State University Law School. He has analyzed all shootings by Chicago police over several years, finding a complex relationship between race, policing, and violence. Professor Sikhon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how did the Police Accountability Task Force in Chicago come to be formed?
The mayor of Chicago, Mayor Emanuel, convened the task force in December of 2015, I believe, and that decision was precipitated by most immediately by the Laquan McDonald shooting video. Well, the shooting had occurred more than a year earlier, but the video was released late last year, and as most of your listeners No, I'm sure, precipitated an outcry in Chicago and nationwide. And so that was really, I think, what precipitated the convening of the task force.
And what were the basic findings of the report that came out a couple of months ago, I believe in April 2016?
What received a lot of attention in the immediate wake of the report's release was its forthright acknowledgement that not only is there a lack of trust between minority communities and the Chicago Police Department, but that racism accounts for that lack of trust. That recognition appears early in the report. Beyond just recognizing that basic fact, the report details the extent to which racial disparity characterizes various dimensions of policing in Chicago, everything from use of force to traffic stops. and details the extent to which the Chicago Police Department is broken. Accountability mechanisms don't function properly. The department regularly fails to identify, let alone discipline, particularly problematic officers. There's a lack of transparency. So the public is kept in the dark as to how the department functions and malfunctions. The report goes on to offer a series of recommendations with regard to how to fix some of these problems. I should say one thing that the report does not talk about in detail is use of force. The report recognizes the extent to which force is used inordinately against members of minority communities, but it doesn't delve into the department's use of force policies or practices in any kind of depth or detail. And the reason offered for that in the report is because the Department of Justice is currently investigating that precise issue.
You examine cases of police shootings in Chicago over a span of several years. Can you tell us a bit about your research and your findings? Was this part of your academic research?
It is. As many scholars have been over the last several years, been interested in police use of force and shootings in particular. And what one finds very, very quickly upon beginning research on that topic is just very little kind of publicly available information about shootings, let alone sort of police violence more generally. It is hard to find repositories of information on the subject. Most departments do not divulge particularly detailed information, if any information, regarding shootings. And I found, sort of by happenstance more than anything else, that the Independent Police Review Authority of Chicago, which is criticized in the task force report and has been criticized by others, but one thing that they seem to do right is to actually make some reasonably detailed information about police shooting incidents available online. What specifically they make available completed, they're redacted, but they're completed reports of investigations following intentional officer-involved shootings. And so that's a good thing, relatively more transparent than any number of other departments. But there were several hundred of these reports posted online and no kind of meaningful synthesis of the information in the reports. And so I made it my task to read these reports and to summarize what I found. And much of it will be unsurprising to you and your listeners. The vast majority of victims or minorities and African Americans in particular. What's somewhat more surprising is that the demographic profile of officer-involved shooters mirrors the demographic profile of the Chicago Police Department. So in other words, I mean, I think the prototypical kind of high-profile police shooting incident that we read about in newspapers tends to involve a white officer and a minority victim. There are any number of minority officers that are involved in these shooting incidents, at least in Chicago. The reason for the what accounts, at least in the most kind of simple sense, for the demographic profile of shooting victims is where the shootings occur. Most of the officer-involved shootings in Chicago occur in neighborhoods that are overwhelmingly poor and black. Now, that invites a series of other questions as to the style of policing that occurs in those neighborhoods. But I don't think it's the case that, or at least the reports that I read tend not to suggest that police shootings, racial disparity in police shootings, are easily understood in terms of the kind of racially malevolent, you know, sort of the racist white cop who's meandering through the streets of Chicago shooting at African-American men. I mean, it seems like there is some connection between the style of policing that occurs in particular places in the city and the identities of those who are shot. But the recommendation is essentially that the mayor and city council think hard about that issue. Right? They don't have any specific recommendations to offer, and one can understand why. Systemic racism entrenched poverty is not the kind of problem that lends to bullet point solutions.
Let me object to one part of that. We've discussed on Law and Disorder about the role that police unions play in how cases are prosecuted, and with the decision out of Baltimore not to hold any police officer accountable. Not to be leading you, but do you have an observation on if police unions are helping sort of perpetuate this notion there's a disproportionate number of police killings of civilians without being held accountable?
Meaning, are police unions making it more difficult to hold individual officers accountable?
Right.
I think they are, and I think the task force actually, to the extent that there are specific recommendations in the task force report, they have a fairly lengthy list, a fairly lengthy and detailed list of provisions of the collective bargaining agreement in Chicago that ought to be rethought. But I don't know so I think police unions are certainly part of the accountability problem. I don't know that we can place kind of entrenched systemic racism and poverty at the feet of the police union, and not certainly not squarely, right? I mean, there's a host of public policy choices that have been made over the course of history that produce this kind of socioeconomic and race outcomes. And we have essentially in this country left it to police departments to deal with those problems, and they're police officers and police departments are not trained, nor are they the best equipped to deal with entrenched patterns of poverty and racism, right? I mean, we've seen this to the extent that the U.S. has ever been kind of a welfare state. We've seen this sort of withdrawal of state institutions from poor neighborhoods, and I don't think we can expect police departments to solve all the problems that exist in these neighborhoods. So, I think police unions are certainly part of an accountability problem. They certainly make it much more difficult to hold individual problem officers accountable. I just think it would be a shame if our analysis of police violence stopped with that kind of narrow accountability question.
Right, and I didn't mean to lay the blame just on the unions, but I do think they are a factor, and especially a factor in the public's perception that the police can get away with sometimes unlawful killings of unarmed civilians. And what I would suggest is increased training would be helpful in that respect, and better supervision. But also, you know, if the Department of Justice finds a pattern in practice of misconduct on the part of the police department in Chicago, then once again we'll see another consent decree. And I feel as though it's a very expensive proposition to have to litigate or investigate something that might be more readily curbed with better training and accountability across the nation.
Well, and I think I think of this in terms of primary, secondary, and tertiary orders of reform, right? I mean, if a department is unable to identify, control, and discipline particularly problematic officers, then we really can't expect... That's got to be the first order of business, right? I mean, a police bureaucracy has got to be able to do those things. Police officers are the only public officials who are authorized to engage in extrajudicial killing, and to the extent that that is true, the police department had best be sure that they are going about their work in a lawful manner. And if the department can't do that, then you've got to start there. And I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that the Chicago Police Department is not capable of performing those very basic supervisory functions. That said, I think it would be a shame if our critical analysis stopped there, and I think it tends to stop there, generally, sort of in media conversations and in legal conversations. I think there are deeper questions about how policing plays out in poor minority neighborhoods, and I think questions about deployment and enforcement strategy bear some relation to when and why shootings and violence occurs. And those deeper structural questions aren't about kind of bad officers. They're about sort of institutional enforcement choices that tend to remain invisible in these conversations. And so, you know, part of my interest in this issue is in identifying those institutional choices and trying to think through what law and policy might have to say about those choices.
Well, we'll definitely look for Blue on Black online and look forward very much to your next work coming out, and want to thank you so much for joining us to talk about this report in Chicago.
Thanks very much for having me.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.